It's around about time to begin. I'm glad to be back with you. It seems like I hadn't seen you in ages. I was joking with somebody that it's flattering and all, but you guys don't have to cancel church when I'm gone. You can go ahead and have services and stuff, but the weather didn't cooperate, so that's the way it goes. We are going to press ahead. This is the start of a new quarter on Wednesday nights, and then, of course, Sunday morning was as well. This particular class we're going to do, a little different, but I think it's going to be something you'll resonate with pretty strongly when we get into it. Let me start. Jeff, would you say a word of prayer for us, and we'll begin. Sometimes I think it's good for preachers to come at questions or topics in a roundabout way, and sometimes it's good to just be direct, and tonight's one of those direct nights for me. I just want to be candid and talk to you a little bit about kind of what launches this particular class that I'm titling, for lack of a better title, Faithful in Our Generations. I had a breakfast meeting with the elders in January, I think. Is that right? Is that when it was? January. And one of the things I asked them was to tell me, you know, what is it you want? What are your concerns for the Glenpool Church of Christ? And, you know, give me an idea of the direction that you think we need to be going in, and what's in between here and there to keep us from being there. You know, what are the problems? And I wanted some direction from my shepherds. And that discussion kind of rattled around for a little bit. You know, quickly a 30-minute breakfast turned into, like, what was it, 3 hours, something like that. You know, as conversations tend to do, because none of our elders like to talk. You know that, right? Yeah. So, yeah, just like all of us, right, we sat and we talked and did all those things. And one thing that came up over and over again was that one of the great blessings of this congregation is the diversity we have in terms of ages. That I can take you to congregations that have a lot of folks 60 and up and none 60 and down, okay? A lot of those. I can even take you to really hip, trendy, cool churches that have a lot of folks that are 45 and down and nobody over than that, okay? Because of the way they do things. There aren't a lot of churches that have a significant number of, and can we just get past the part where I offend you, older members and younger members? Is anyone going to throw at me anything? I'm sorry. Just get it out of your system, all right? Senior, Lenora says, I'll talk to you later. Yeah. Lenora is one of the younger members, so that's not who I was talking about. But senior members and more junior members, how about that? There aren't a lot of churches that have that variety and have it under one roof, have it in one worship service. So I have a friend who's in he used to work with a community church in Edmond that had a couple thousand. And he said, yeah, we have all kinds of different age groups. I said, how do you do that? He says, well, we have one worship service for one group and one worship service for another group. And it is completely, it's like being at different churches that happen to meet on the same campus. If you want to completely do church differently for whoever wants to show up at what time, then I suppose you can completely cater to one group and the other and never ask them to be in the same room together. But it's a special treat to have those people under the same roof at the same time for a worship service. In Bible classes, even though we do some breaking up based on age, a lot of our classes are mixed ages and groups and backgrounds and so forth. That is an incredible blessing. With that blessing comes a unique problem. A church that only has members 60 and up, I'm just arbitrarily picking 60, you can pick any number, doesn't have to worry about how to get different generations to work together, to share their faith together, and to worship together. Does that make sense? If you only cater to one age group or the other, then you don't have to worry about how to get them to get along. Okay? So one of the better things that's being accomplished here in Glenpool also presents something of a problem. It's not a bad problem. It's one of the things we've used this phrase so often the last 8 years. It's kind of cliche now. It's a good problem, right? It's great that we have all those people here, but the result is sometimes we have what we might call a generation gap, where the atmosphere and behavior and standards and norms that one group might expect don't always line up with the other group, and yet we've said we're under the same roof, worshiping at the same time, being in the same church, under the same eldership. Okay. And so one of the things that we've been talking about, both just in-house discussions, and I've been picking people's brains that I know that work in congregations like this, which, by the way, are increasingly rare. I mean, the default now, I hate to tell you this, if it's news to you, then it's going to be shocking news, but the default now is to build churches around an age group. Pick your demographic, cater to that group, do what they want, get as many in as possible, make them happy, whether that's old folks, young folks, middle folks, whatever. That's the way ministers are being trained, and we've just decidedly said we don't want to do that. Even while we're happy to have, you know, senior saints go on a trip or young families do an activity, we also have been, the elders have told us over and over again, even before this conversation, we want to emphasize times where all those folks get together in worship, in Bible class, in service, in just eating and having fun and things like that. And that is a unique challenge. So what is it that creates some of the distance that we perceive? It might just be a perception, or it might be real, or it might be both. But that seems to separate some of what we might call the older crowd from the younger crowd. Well, needless to say, that is not a question I can fix in a Bible class, right? That would be a silly thing to attempt. But as part of talking about the problem, and I think that's part of the solution, is talking about the problem, recognizing it. We do have a diverse group age-wise. Let's talk about that. This class is going to try to talk about that head-on and think about how the Bible imagines churches to operate, because I think this is the right model. Let me just say that before I go any further. I think this is the right way of doing church. I think you're supposed to have children and their parents and their grandparents and their aunts and uncles and great-grandparents sharing pews and chairs and auditorium space and worshiping together. I think that's the way that it's designed to work, and I think it's a mistake to try to piecemeal it out into separate organizations. But that does create unique challenges we have to work with. So let me tonight introduce the idea of how does the Bible imagine that generations work individually and together. Next week, I'm going to talk about, so what are the generations like that we have under our roof? And then from there, we're going to actually try to work on it. So tonight, let me just get started. I want to start in kind of an odd place maybe, but Exodus chapter 25 through 6. Exodus chapter 25 through 6. This is at almost the beginning of the Ten Commandments. We're just a verse or two into the Ten Commandments. And the Ten Commandments themselves are a set of laws given with generations in mind. Okay, Israel, it wasn't all one age group of people that came out of Egypt, was it? It was a nation that came out of Egypt. And so you had little kids and older folks and so forth and all in between. So at Sinai, Moses is given commandments and instructed, you're going to give these to the heads of households and tribes, but then that information is going to be disseminated down so that the whole nation knows how to live. Listen to what's said. Who has for us Exodus chapter 25 through 6? This is the middle of the don't have a graven image commandment. James, you want to read that for us? What's interesting about that, that's different than the way we think about things. We think about an individual person is given a commandment, and he either keeps it or he doesn't, and then he's either punished or rewarded depending on what he chose to do. That's the way we think about interacting with God. God says to do something, Ben, you do something, and either I do it or I don't. Jim doesn't have to deal with the consequences of whether Ben did or didn't do the commandment. That's the way we think of it. Everybody as kind of their own person. But that's a fairly modern idea. In the Bible, that's just not the way God talks very often. There are some things where he says, now this is up to you, make a choice, no doubt. But more often, when God gives commandments, he tells us that generations are going to stand and fall together. It rarely says, and there was a guy named, I'll pick on Jim some more. There was a guy named Jim in Israel who had an idol. It usually says, Israel worshipped idols. That generation, that's usually the word. Even more often, the nation or people or tribe, it's that generation did not know God. And they are judged as a group. And you can say, well, that's not fair. I don't know. But that's the way God did it. And I think God is fair. He held them accountable for the way they lived together. And so he thinks of them as generations. Also, you'll notice in this passage that generations have consequences for each other. What happens if one generation does iniquity in verse 5? Yeah, how many? There could be three or four generations of consequences for one generation's failure. Right? That it's not just, as the poet Donne used to say, no man is an island to himself. You're not in this on your own. Choices you make will affect the next generation of people. And maybe the ones after them, and maybe the ones after them. Sneak preview of next week. The three or four generation thing I actually think is important. So generations, we usually think of them as in like 40-year groups, but really it's like a 20-year age group of people. Three or four generations in terms of overlap is 60 to 80 years. You might be shocked how many things in the Bible happen in 60 and 80-year cycles. The book of Judges is almost an entire story told in 40, 60, 80-year cycles. Where one generation makes a choice, consequences play out for three or four, and then something changes. Okay, so I don't think this is just a throwaway phrase. I don't think it's just poetry. Oh, three or four generations. I think he means, no, actually, you can have consequences for several multiple generations based on decisions that are made. And I'll try to make that case next week out of Judges, but I'll save it for them. What about if you do right? Verse 6, if you do right and serve God, does that just do good for you? Yeah, the influence, it multiplies. Yeah. Now, again, we've really emphasized, and preachers have been real good about this through the years, you know, you can't get into heaven on your parents' coattails, right? You got to do it for yourself and all that. And that's fine. I understand the point we're making. But God says, you know, good things you do multiplies. In fact, multiplies more than evil. Which one has more consequence? Three or four generations or thousands, right? I think the point is that good can last for a long time. How many people were blessed by Abraham? Because of Abraham, through Abraham. Down to us. I mean, it's still rolling. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole story of the Bible. Of, yes, terrible things happen and it sidetracks the blessings. But the blessings outlive the curses. Good things last a long time if you take care of them. Does that make sense? So I think that passage really points us in a direction of a different kind of thinking. Stop for, you know, one quarter. We'll all be right where we were when we left. Don't worry. But for one quarter, let's not think of ourselves. Let's think of ourselves as part of a group of generations that are living and interacting with other generations of people. Okay, what do generations do in the Bible? I'm going to make a case that basically there's two basic activities that generations do in relationship to each other in the Bible. Okay, the first one is kind of top to bottom, and that is they pass on or convey something. Okay, so one task of generations is time has an arrow, right? It's not reversible. You don't go throw it in reverse and go the other way. Time moves a certain direction. And so the older generation has been handed something precious, maybe several somethings precious, and they are supposed to keep handing it down. And the next generation takes the handoff, takes the baton, and the greatest of all human relay races, and we just hand that baton on, and we're passing that down. So the most basic function of generations is that every generation stands in between the one before them and the one after. And so their primary job is to help pass on or convey something. I'll get to what in just a second. The second things that generations do is they share and unite together. If generations are so important, why didn't God just have every generation live by itself? You live till you're 40, you drop dead, and then a new child springs up and takes over from there, right? Why do we have overlap? Why does God have it where grandparents and their children and then their children all live kind of at the same time and it overlaps? Apparently, this is the way it's supposed to work, right? That it's not supposed to just start over every so many years, that it's supposed to work together. That means that group of people has to learn how to work together, don't they? Because we are the people who are alive right now. Okay? That's who we are. That's who God made us to be. And so we get to work with all the other people alive right now. And some of them are going to be older than us, and some of them are going to be younger than us. All of them are going to be different than us. But we're going to find out how to work together. So transferring, handing off something, and then sharing and working together in things. Those are the two things the Bible describes. Let me make my case. Starting with passing on. First thing I think the Bible talks about passing on is faith. Turn to the book of Psalms, if you would. And I'm just going to do a quick hit of several passages in succession. I start in Psalm 71, verse 18. I just kind of pick these verses arbitrarily. There's 30 or 40 more we could add it to the list, but at some point it's overkill. One thing that comes up forever and ever and ever and always in the Old Testament, especially in the Psalms, is tell your children what God did. Okay? So listen to these passages. Let me just read a few of them. This is 71, verse 18. So even to old age and gray hairs, O God, do not forsake me until I proclaim your might to another generation, your power to all those to come. What's the point? He says, God, stay with me so I can live long enough to tell the next generation what they need to hear from me. I've been given something to pass on, and I don't want it to stop here. Let me live to gray hairs. Some of us got ours early, but that's okay. Some of them just fell right out. Right? But to gray hair and old age, be with me so I can pass to the next group what they need to hear. 78, verse 4. Let's turn to page 2. 78, verse 4. Actually, start at verse 1 because it's just a good passage. 78, 1 through 4. Give ear, O my people, to my teaching. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings from of old, things that we have heard and known that our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, but tell to the coming generation the glorious deeds of the Lord and his might, and the wonders that he has done. So what's emphasized? Part of what's passed on is instruction for living. I'm going to give you parables and dark sayings and so forth. Save that for a minute. I'm going to come back to that in the next slide. But the other big point of emphasis is, I want to tell you what God did so that you don't forget what God has done. That's important. Skip a few pages. How about Psalm 102? Verse 18. Psalm 102, verse 18, specifically tells us that's what he's doing. Let this be recorded for a generation to come, so that a people yet to be created may praise the Lord. Even, now this is big, he's not even talking about just his children or grandchildren. He says, write this down, even after I'm dead. I want to continue passing down to the next, to generations that haven't been born yet. I want them to hear what I have to say about what God has done so that no one ever forgets. Even if their parents forget, I'm going to tell them, write it down. Give it to my great-great-grandkids, right? Keep going a little further. Psalm 145, this will be the last one. Psalm 145 and verse 4. Psalm 145, beginning in verse 4. One generation shall commend your works to another, and shall declare your mighty work or mighty acts. On the glorious splendor of your majesty, and on your wondrous works I will meditate. They shall speak of the might of your awesome deeds, and I will declare your greatness. They shall pour forth the fame of your abundant goodness, and shall sing aloud of your righteousness. Okay. So, have I made my case yet? Over and over again in the Psalms and elsewhere, the task of one generation was to tell the next what God has done. Okay, and I say it, notice it was said in just that way every time. The next slide I'm going to talk about telling them how to live. That to me is a different category. The first thing you tell them is what God did. Sometimes, and I'm just saying this, if anybody needs to hear it and apply it to them, that's up to you. See, I'm not even pointing fingers or looking at anybody. Sometimes we get in a hurry to get to the tell them what to do part. The first thing we do is tell them what God has done. That's the reason we should care what to do, right? It doesn't matter what to do unless we know who we're doing it for. And so the first thing we see, and if you read the Old Testament, it always goes this way. It starts out by saying, the God who spoke to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the God who brought you out of Egypt, now tells you to do this. What he did, and then what to do. So the first thing we need to convey is, what do we know about God? What has he done? That's step number one. Now the second thing is to pass on wisdom. This is what to do with your life. Okay. If you want, we could read Titus chapter 2, 1 through 8, probably the most famous passage on this thought. Titus chapter 2, 1 through 8. Let me just start with verse 1, because there's a funny thing that happens. Titus 2, verse 1, but as for you, teach what accords with sound doctrine. Now, what does sound doctrine mean? The word sound means healthy, or whole, or put together right. Ladies, you go to the grocery store and you pick out a fruit. You pick one up and then you put it back and then you get the right one. How do you know which is the right one to get? I'm really asking. I go shopping now and I have no idea. How do you know the right one to get? The way it feels, right? I mean, it feels right. This is a ripe fruit. This is the way it's supposed to feel. Does it smell right? Okay, does it smell like it? Okay. That's the meaning of the word sound. That is it, some of you might literally thump it and say, yeah, okay. Is it right? Is it healthy? Okay, that's the word here. Teach healthy doctrine. Okay. But he doesn't stop there. My entire life, I've heard that verse used. I've never heard anybody keep going. The verse 2 tells you how to accomplish that. And it's not actually merely the task of a preacher in a pulpit. Listen to what he says. Older men are to be sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled, sound in faith, in love, and in steadfastness. Older women, likewise, are to be reverent in behavior, not slanderers or slaves to much wine. They are to teach what is good, and so train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, pure, working at home, kind and submissive to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be reviled. Likewise, urge the younger men to be self-controlled. Show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works, and in your teaching show integrity, dignity, and sound speech that cannot be condemned, so that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say about us. What was going to be the first and earliest slander against the church? You know, they've undermined society, they're tearing up the traditional home, they're radicals. Don't listen to these Christians. And Paul says, step one of convincing the world that our doctrine is healthy is we have to look healthy. We have to know how to live. And to do that, some of you older folks, he says, are going to have to live good lives in front of younger folks. You're responsible to that. And not just to live it, but to convey it, to say, here's how to live. And younger folks, you have a task in this. Everybody has a job to do in sharing in that wisdom of how to live a life. And it's done together. And that's what follows when Paul says, hold the sound doctrine. This is what healthy Christian living looks like. is older and younger people figuring out how to live together. Some of the details are fascinating. I could preach a very long sermon on just this passage, because some of the details are really interesting. The one that I'll do two. Two that are interesting. Keepers at home. Now, some of the rabbis literally thought if a woman left the house, she'd probably sin. So they literally need to stay inside the door. I don't think that's what Paul is saying, for what it's worth. One of the words here is despotes oikos. This is despotes is the iron fist despot, is where we get our English word despot. She is the despot of the home. She knows how to run her household, right? I mean, it's actually a strangely empowering word, that she knows how to run the business of the family. This is a very active woman, okay? And she knows how to do that. And then it tells her how to love her husband and children. Why would you have to tell somebody that? Didn't you fall in love and then get married? Not necessarily. This is a world of arranged marriages. How do I love my husband? How do I love these kids that he gave me? Did I want this? It was going to take some older woman wisdom to say, yeah, I didn't really like my husband either. But here's how we made it work. And we've been making it work for 40 years, right? Older ladies, you have no idea how, and older men, you have no idea how much younger married people sometimes need someone to put their arm around them and say, yeah, I didn't like Jim either for a few years, but we're still together. It's okay, you know? I mean, it's I'm picking on Jim all day. I'm sorry. Jim was one of the first people to come say welcome back, and that's what he gets. But really, you do need somebody to put their arm around you and say, yeah, we had rough times too. Once it was terrible, and here we are. No, it's not agape. This is not even the deep sacrificial love. This is teach you how to get to put up with your kids, like how to tolerate your kids. Does every parent know that sometimes your kids are intolerable? Yeah. How do you do that? Sometimes you need an older mother and an older father to say, yeah, we tried to leave ours behind a few times, but we stuck it out and we're glad. That's why we have locked doors, to keep them in, not, you know. Who had a hand here? James and then Devin. Sorry? Yeah, and five, yeah. Yeah, the wording that Paul uses is interesting. Where he chooses to use the command for love and where he uses other words is fascinating. But where do you learn that? You learn it from people who figured it out. Yeah.
This is, in a way, the exact opposite of what we see on Facebook when we see this picture of the happy, perfect family.
Yeah.
Of course, my bride and I are in love, and here are our perfect children at a beach.
Yeah. Picture perfect.
Yeah, island.
Yeah. It's absolutely true. I'll just tell you, as a minister, one of the things I do and don't advertise, one of the things that I end up doing from time to time, I think most ministers do, is talking to members who have decided to leave. It's one of the weird parts of my job that someone says, I'm not going to go here anymore, and you say, well, could you talk to me over a cup of coffee, and you have a chat. One thing that comes up a lot, I'm not going to say in every case, but comes up more often than you might guess, is this sentiment. Everybody at that church acts like they have it all together and they have it all figured out, and I don't belong there. And I'm always surprised. I don't know why. I shouldn't be surprised, right? But somehow, instead of saying, yes, we're messed up just like you, let me help you with that, we've said, yes, we're doing fine, you straighten out. And I don't think we've ever said it. I mean, no one gets up in the pulpit and says, everybody here is doing just great, right? Never happens. But somehow people are coming away with the idea that there's nobody there that struggles like I do. So how do you remedy that? You put your arm around somebody that's struggling and say, I have that same problem. and you make a friend, and you talk about it. And that's one of the things generations do to each other in sharing wisdom. I'm going to run out of time, so I won't turn to the verses in Proverbs, but if you read the book of Proverbs, the entire book is framed around things my daddy told me. Like the first eight chapters all start with, son, listen here. That's how every chapter starts. Proverb 31 starts with, and this was something my mother taught me. Every proverb section starts with, this is wisdom from an older person to a younger person to help you know how to live. Okay? So point number one I want to make about what do generations do? They pass down and convey. They pass it down. Okay? And that means getting involved. You can't pass down. It's not a deep pass, right? This is not a Hail Mary. Hope they get it. Good luck, kids. This is a handoff. Okay? This is the close, intimate contact. Okay? Next, sharing. A couple of passages just I think are helpful. Joel chapter 2 and verse 28. Joel chapter 2 and verse 28 is a prophecy about the coming kingdom. I know it is because Peter quotes it in Acts chapter 2 and says, this is what Joel was talking about. Okay? So the church is connected to what we're about to read in verse 28. Okay. And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, your old men shall dream dreams, and your young men shall see visions. That is an interesting description, because that's not what Mount Sinai looked like. At Mount Sinai, the old men went up to talk to Moses, and then they went back to their families and tribes and told them what needed to happen next. Joel says, well, here's what's going to happen coming up. I see men and women working together. I see old people and young people working together. And that's how the kingdom's going to operate. That's a very different picture. But that's his description of the church. We need men and women in the church. We need old people and young people in the church. We can't have one or the other in the life of the church. Everybody has something different to offer. Old men don't offer the same thing as young men. And I don't think men offer the same thing as women and vice versa. But we need what each of those provides in the church. It's essential. They have a task, a God-given task. So the work of the kingdom would not fall to just one generation. It's going to fall to a group or even one gender. It's going to fall to all these. If you're alive right now, that's you. Here comes the kingdom. Now get to work. God's people would be blessed together, and they would work together. That was the way it was intended to be. So in Acts chapter 2, the group of people that are there, you got people from all countries, you got all sorts of people. It's just like a cross-section of the crowd that happens to hear what Peter and the apostles have to say. And that becomes the church. And that's what churches are supposed to look like. Okay. To reinforce that, New Testament, 1 John chapter 2, 12 through 14. This is a strange little passage just for fun's sake. I don't know if John's trying to write a poem here or what, but it's kind of like rhythmical and repeats itself. It's kind of interesting. 1 John chapter 2, 12 through 14. Anybody want to read that? 1 John chapter 2, 12 through 14. David, go ahead. Okay, so there's six rounds there. How many different groups of people does he name age-wise? Three groups, okay? Which is fascinating. So when I first had this conversation with the elders, and we were talking about the church and kind of where we were as a congregation, I tended to oversimplify it in my own mind. I thought, well, we got old folks and young folks. Is that how a church looks? Almost never. a church that's got all the way up and down the ladder, you're going to have old folks and middle folks and young folks and younger still folks, right? Tripping over their diaper folks. I mean, you're going to have all the way up and down, right? This group had three generations of people that he describes. Now, whether he means this literally, like they were literally that old, or like he means more, some of you are new converts, some of you are old converts, I don't know. But he does say that there are people here of different groups as far as your age and maturity. None of them does he say, now you guys are a mess, straighten out. Right? Each one, he says, you have something that I need to talk to you about that you have to offer the church. Okay? So let's start with the little children, which are either, again, literally little kids, could be, or new converts would be maybe my guess. The youngest converts in the church, maybe our young families group or something. I don't know where you put that. What two things does he say about them? Actually, it's one thing he says. Well, no, it's two. What two things? What's the first one? Their sins are forgiven. What does a new convert know? Maybe not much. But forgiveness of sins, Jesus saves, right? Step one, you got that far. That's great. That's more important than you might guess. So hang on to that, little children. What's the second thing? The end of verse 13. You know the Father. You know who God is, right? What do we tell a new convert? Here's who God is. Jesus saves, right? I mean, that's the basics. If you haven't got that far, I don't know where to go next. He says, okay, you youngest of the church, you've got those two things. Hang on to that. That's important. Let me tell you something. A church can forget those two things. A church can forget that we're here because Jesus saves and God is who he says he is. And sometimes you need new converts to remind you that's why we're here. They brought that to the forefront of the church's attention every day. And when the preacher preached those meat and potato sermons that everyone said, oh, I've heard all this before, it was for those folks. But it turns out everybody else needed to hear it too. What's the second group? How about young men or fathers? Let's do fathers. I guess they're next. Fathers, what does he tell the fathers? Verse 13. You know him from the beginning. And what's the second thing he says? Same thing. They have a deep and abiding relationship with God. They've known God longer. So when the elder Polycarp was burnt at the stake, they said, deny Jesus and we'll let you free. He says, 86 years have I known him and he did me no harm. Why would I deny him now? I'm 86 years old. I've known God a really long time. See the point? He says, the church needs your stability. That long, deep relationship with God. It's been cold lately. Anybody have a fireplace, wood burning in the house? Corey's have one? Okay. What logs keep you warm? Is it the one that you douse in kerosene at the start that flashes up real big? Or is it the one on the back that's burning slowly all night long, right? That's the one that keeps you warm. The backlog. The church needs backlogs. You didn't know your backlogs, but there you are. We need, the flashy stuff sounds great. And you got to start the fire somehow. Don't get me wrong. But what keeps the church burning is the backlog, is the warmth that keeps it going. Okay. And then how about young men? Verse 13. They're overcome. And then verse 14, you're strong. And the word of God abides in you. Okay. There's a generation in the middle there that seems to be in between new convert and somebody with an old relationship with God. They were, in many cases, the front line of the church. Stephen's the one going out and preaching and getting himself killed. Right? It's that in-between crowd that provides church leadership, that is in the trench of the church, doing tough work. And John says, we need you too. So, which group was most important? Apparently, that's not the point, is it? That it takes these three groups working together to have a healthy church. That was the goal of having a church. Each generation has its own strength. You're all different. Okay? You aren't supposed to be the same. But every group needs something the other group gives. If you've been to a congregation and lived in a congregation, and again, trying to say this very politely, I hope you don't take it the wrong way, that only has gray heads in the room, you know the energy that is brought into a church when a crying baby comes screaming down the aisle, right? I mean, what irritates us, because we've kind of got a lot of them, is a blessing to that crowd that says, we wish we had a baby crying somewhere interrupting the preacher, right? The enthusiasm of just having warm little bodies in the room with their delight, singing Jesus Loves Me in Bible class and doing coloring pages, that means something to a church that you can't do without. We've got it. We've got it coming out our ears. Okay? It's not a curse, it's a blessing. It's just we have to figure out what to do with all that. And it's to share all that together. I'm going to run out of time. I've got to hurry. Last verse tonight. Turn to Malachi chapter 4. Interestingly enough, this is the very last verse of the very last book of our Old Testament. Very last verse, very last chapter, very last book. What is the final passing warning to all those people at the end of the Old Testament who were going to be waiting till Jesus came? Somebody read for me Malachi chapter 4 and verse 6.
He will rebuke and he will turn the hearts of fathers to their children and the hearts of children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the land with the decree of utter destruction.
The end. Isn't that a nice place to end a sermon, right? And if you don't do that, you're all going to burn. The end. That's the end of Malachi. What does he say they have to do? What do they have to get right to avoid a terrible curse? Two things, okay? Fathers, let's get it right. Fathers are going to turn to children and children to their fathers. Which one might you expect would come up? Children need to listen to their fathers. Now that one sounds right, right? You young whippersnappers need to listen to what we've got to say, right? That one sounds right to me. And it is right, because he says it right there, right? A big chunk of the Bible is spent telling younger people, listen, they're trying to tell you something. And the reason the Bible has to keep saying it is because young people don't listen, right? It's kind of in the DNA or something, I don't know. But there it is. That one we expected. What's the other one? Fathers need to turn to their children. What does that even mean? I saw, speaking of those silly pictures on Facebook, Devin, I saw one the other day that I thought was actually pretty interesting. It had an older man and a young child wearing identical T-shirts standing next to each other. Only one word was different on the shirt. The old man had a shirt that said, talk to kids, they know cool stuff. And the kid had a shirt that said, talk to old folks, they know cool stuff. And it's true, right? I mean, kids actually... I know there comes an age where that we know everything and don't ever want to listen to you again, but there is a time when kids recognize the truth that folks have cool things to tell them, and they listen, and that's wonderful. And we have to continue that process. That said, if you want to know how to use your cell phone, ask my 9-year-old, right? And he's the one that's going to help you on that. Right, that there is information that goes both ways. And that seems to be the sense here, that this isn't an instruction just for one generation. He doesn't say, now this group has got it just right, everybody listen to them from now on. What does he say? You folks are going to have to listen to each other. The older folks did some things right, and they did them well. And the children need to listen to it. Older folks, you did some things not so well, and your children are going to tell you about it. And neither one of those conversations is fun, is it? Right? Because everybody likes being told you're wrong about something. Yeah. No, none of us do. But that conversation has to go both ways. Okay. And so we need to have that taking place. Sir?
What you touched on tonight, and it seems to me like, is the responsibility within the family as a father, seeing that the children are taught and they are trained. See, that's so prevalent.
How come you ask me good questions when I'm out of time? That's a great question. Okay, let me, I really do not want to skip that, because that is an essential question. We need to talk about Proverbs 22:6, because it seems to say something is true, that as Carl says, in our experience, it doesn't seem like it works that way. It seems like you do what you thought was best with your kids, and they don't turn out well. In fact, the Bible is full of really good men who had really bad kids. It's absolutely true. So what does that mean? So let's take tonight as, here's the way it's supposed to work. But then I want to come back to Carl's question next week of, so what's going on? Because it hasn't seemed to work that way. Is that fair? Because that's an excellent question we need to talk about. Thank you for the comments and attention tonight.